The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Well, welcome to the first panel. And for the first panel of this event, we thought we would have a panel to review how international law has changed over the past 25 years and to maybe peer a little bit into the future and think if we can see what international law might evolve into over the next 25 years. To address these issues and to start our discussions, we have a very distinguished panel. I know that in the programs you have all the bios of all the speakers, so I'm just going to give you their current titles and not give you take up valuable time giving you their bios when you can read that. But in the order in which they will speak, our panelists who I think will be well known to you. The first speaker will be Professor Robert Goldman, who many of you I know from the time you were studying here. Second speaker will be Professor Sabine Schlemmer-Schulte, who's now an associate professor at McGeorge School of Law and one of our distinguished alums. The third speaker will be Dean Claudio Grossman. Fourth speaker is Professor Balakrishnan Rajagopal, who is currently a professor and a director of the program on human rights and justice at the Center for International Studies at MIT, and was one of my first students, I think, at the law school. And the final speaker will be Mr. Rutsal Marta, who's currently the general counsel for Interpol. In designing this panel, we asked the panelists to address one of four questions, which I'll tell you, so that if they don't address any of these questions, you can ask them in question time. The first one is, what are the two most important developments in international law, in your opinion, over the past 25 years? The second one is, what are the two biggest problems that international law has failed to address over the past 25 years? Third is, what are likely to be the two biggest challenges facing international law over the next 25 years? And the final question is, what can lawyers do to help the international community meet the challenges that the international order is likely to face over the next quarter century? So to address those small questions, let me invite Bob Goldman to begin.
Well, first of all, I'm delighted to be here today and to see so many of my former students and to know that you're doing so well and that you care enough about the institution to want to come back, and so welcome. I get to plead ignorance because, I knew I was going to be on the panel. I didn't pay very much attention to what all of these questions were. And so what I'm going to do is speak about several things that I think are important that have happened in the last 25 years. I know there are certain panels that are going to explore certain things on the implications of the war on terror, but I could spend my whole time talking about the damage that the conception of the struggle against terrorism has done, not only to the United States, but to international institutions, as well as to international law, particularly human rights and in the law of war, but I will leave that. Where we really do have some extremely, if you look back 25 years and I try to identify certain things, and this way I'll try to comply to some extent with what Danny wanted me to do. Let me mention four things: the areas of impunity, individual criminal responsibility, interrelationship between human rights and the law of armed conflict, and the important evolving and new roles of civil society institutions, particularly international non-governmental organizations, in shaping international law and, quite frankly, driving the agenda. Now, first of all, 25 years ago, at the end of so-called dirty wars that had occurred around the world, as well as actual armed conflicts, it was normal and it was customary that the government would give very broad amnesties to its own agents who had committed the most serious and atrocious kinds of violations, either of human rights and or international humanitarian law. Beginning in the mid-1980s, particularly within the Western Hemisphere, as a result of challenges to amnesty laws, beginning with those that challenged the amnesties in Argentina during the Alfonsín period, as well as those in the Sanguinetti government in Uruguay, led in 1992 to the first cases that declared amnesties to be incompatible with fundamental rules of a treaty, the American Convention on Human Rights. I had some involvement with that, and then when Claudio Grossman and I coincided as members of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, we had the opportunity to also begin to consolidate the jurisprudence by striking down amnesty laws in Chile, Guatemala, and El Salvador, and then finally in the case of laws put through by the Fujimori government, which were among the most extreme, we found those laws to be violative of the American Convention, and we actually sent the cases to the Inter-American Court, which in the Barrios Altos case declared the amnesties to violate multiple provisions of the American Convention, and that those laws to effectively be null and void without legal effect. This is a remarkable development because it not only led the Constitutional Court in, I believe, in Peru to implement the decision, but just several years ago, in a long process in Argentina, the Argentine Supreme Court looked at the decisions in Barrios Altos as well as the Inter-American Commission's decisions and effectively nullified the final stop and due obedience laws that have reopened criminal proceedings. This was unimaginable 25 years ago. This has coincided, particularly what's happened in the Americas, with a growing international movement against impunity and for the imposition of individual criminal responsibility for serious violations, both of human rights as well as the law of armed conflict. Among the worst crimes, and they're crimes of universal jurisdiction, are war crimes and grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions and of the Protocol 1. And as you know, as a result of the human rights, and particularly humanitarian law violations committed in the former Yugoslavia, in Rwanda, in Sierra Leone and so forth, we had had a series of ad hoc courts that were established. And one of the most remarkable things is really without a firm treaty basis, as a result of a decision of the International Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, it found in the Tadic case that there was individual criminal responsibility for serious violations of norms of non-international armed conflict, including Common Article 3. Now, as a result of the movements of governments, NGOs, world opinion, we finally have a international criminal court that has jurisdiction to deal both with serious violations of international as well as international armed conflict rules. And I think the days of impunity, in the sense, we haven't completely done away with it. But there is greater intolerance, and indeed we have a firm legal basis today, as well as the growth of universal jurisdiction laws at the domestic level, where we know that the perpetrators of serious violations of human rights and IHL norms will perhaps enjoy no peace, and they'll have to stay in their countries and so forth. That's a major development. The other thing that I'd like to point out is, because I teach in these areas and I've seen the development, 25 years ago there was kind of a hermetic seal between the law of war and human rights. And yet today, by virtue of a series of decisions of the International Court of Justice, as well as the developing jurisprudence within the Inter-American system and the Human Rights Committee, and the slow but I think inevitable steps that the European Court of Justice will take as a result of cases from Chechnya, Turkey, and other places, we are seeing that these two areas of law are not viewed as separate, but as interrelated and complementary. That human rights law does apply during armed conflict situations, and it applies extraterritorially. And that the two now have to be viewed as sort of a mutually reinforcing and complementary set of norms that should supply victims of armed conflict with the highest level of care. This is very much still evolving, but as I said, it was something which one would not have thought would have happened some 25 years ago. If you look at non-governmental organizations 25 years ago, they were evolving. There were several major ones, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, and so forth, and a variety of others. Today, there are virtually thousands of non-governmental organizations working both domestically and internationally with broad networks. There is hardly an area of international law that one could look at where NGOs are not only active, but in many ways they have become the catalysts for change. And in areas that, quite frankly, particularly like in the law of war area, the banning of anti-personnel landmines was largely the work of non-governmental organizations working in coalition. This just was inconceivable that this area that was dominated by states and the military, that you would have non-governmental organizations beginning to set the agenda and to be working with states, and they actually achieved a rather universal, not entirely, ban on anti-personnel landmines. And I will predict to you that you will see the same thing is beginning to happen with the use of cluster bombs, as well as various other kinds of weapons. This was an area, monitoring of war, which was something that was very exclusive to the military. Now wars are fought in the gaze of CNN and Al Jazeera, the BBC, and non-governmental organizations are writing almost immediate critiques of the way in which warring parties are conducting themselves. If you look at the environment, if you look at financial institutions, if you look at things dealing with trade, workers' rights, and so forth and so on, non-governmental organizations are at the forefront. I will just terminate my remarks or finish them by saying that I think one of the great challenges is whether or not the approach that many states has taken to dealing with terrorism, whether these will continue when the Bush administration ends in 22 months, or whether or not these things become permanent features, and what the implications this will have for both international law, for treaty monitoring bodies and so forth, such as the kind that Dean Grossman sat on or that we sat on together, such as the Inter-American Commission. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bob. Sabine.
Yes, it's a real great pleasure for me to be back here. I'd like to look at my area of interest in international law, which is international economic law, and that encompasses, in my view, international monetary law, international finance and development, international trade and investment law. And let me upfront answer Denny's first question. I believe there's, in terms of the two achievements that international law can record for the past 25 years, there's number one, the World Bank Inspection Panel, and number two, it's the establishment of the Heavily Indebted Poor Countries Trust Fund by the bank and International Monetary Fund together. And I'm looking at international economic law, number one, from the institutional perspective, and that leads me into the big question of the lack of accountability of international organizations, and I view the inspection panel as the appropriate first step in answering that issue of lack of accountability of international organizations. And I'm looking at the HIPIC Trust Fund as a first step in answering what I see as a real big issue in terms of the substantive regulation of international economic frameworks, of the substantive framework for the global economy, and that is the imbalance and the widening of the North and South gap. And I see the debt forgiveness in connection with the HIPIC Trust Fund as one of the first steps to kind of create a more level playing field for the players in the North and in the South. Yes, the first big issue. There is a gap in international law when it comes to international organizations, because international organizations are not number one, subject to the entire range of substantive international law that exists. The reason being that international organizations haven't ratified all sorts of international treaties that states are parties to, which means that they escape from scrutiny when it comes to human rights, labor rights, and the like. Number two, they are also not subject to customary international law in the same big areas. They just reject the notion of being subject to customary international law, and they are justified in terms of their legal argument because they haven't been contributing to the making of that type of customary law. Certainly, they are not subject to the general principle of international law because those derive from state-made law, national law, and they are not, the international organizations don't want to be subjected to that kind of state law. So what remains for them is essentially their own homemade law that they feel they should be bound by, which is obviously the charter that created them, and the international treaties they themselves enter into, in the case of the World Bank, these are the loan agreements and the like, and potentially the internal policies that form the financing conditionalities for international financial institutions such as the World Bank. So there is, in terms of volume of international law, a relatively small part that international organizations are bound by. And number two, there's basically no fora in the world where these international organizations can be held accountable to any breaches of the small volume of international law that they are subject to, because they can't be dragged into the International Court of Justice. They have no standing there, and they can't be even neither as plaintiff nor as defendant. If at all, they can be dragged before international arbitration, but only if they consent to such type of arbitration. So in fact, and in addition, the third thing is they are immune from the jurisdiction of national courts, with tiny exceptions such as when they borrow on the market. In that instance, for example, the World Bank can be dragged into a national court. But for the rest of their operations, be it standard setting or be it financing development, there is no court in the world that could ever hold them accountable if they are not complying with their own homemade standards or the treaties they enter into. And because of this sort of, it's of course a situation that derives from the history. States came with immunity, and so international organizations came with immunity too. But in today's times, with many, especially the action-oriented international organizations, having so much of an impact on many people in the world, in the case of the financial institutions, primarily on people in the third world, it is a real dilemma in which we live here, because there is no such thing as holding International Monetary Fund and the World Bank accountable somewhere. So that's where, in fact, I believe the inspection panel that was created in 1994 is a first unique step in giving individuals in the third world that potentially are negatively affected by World Bank finance projects the possibility to have an independent body investigate to what extent the World Bank itself has lived up to its own homemade standards when financing development in developing countries. I personally believe in the next 25 years that inspection panel, which right now only gives recommendations, should gradually be turned into a real court that would issue final decisions and by which then the World Bank and its staff should abide too. The panel itself is problematic in the sense that not all World Bank financed activities are subject to that panel. There is a big question mark to what extent the now called development policy lending, formerly adjustment lending, is subject to the inspection panel. There are activities such as giving grants to developing countries that don't come in the typical format of project finance, so these are not subject to the inspection panel either. And then there are public-private partnerships the World Bank engages in that may not be subject to the panel. And there are also technical assistance programs that are not subject to the panel scrutiny. And finally, there is also the big question mark with respect to all of the other institutions, the international financial institutions activities that may not yet have established some such thing as the inspection panel. The one thing that falls short of what the panel does is, for example, when it comes to fighting corruption and bribery in developing countries where firms of the northern countries bribe officials in developing countries in order to get the contracts awarded that are part of procurement under World Bank financed projects, these firms can be blacklisted on the bank's webpage. That means they can be made ineligible for being part of any further subcontracts under World Bank finance contracts. And that blacklisting is obviously something that's very negative for the reputation of these countries and also has a financial impact on them. These firms can't hold the bank accountable for what they're doing before a real independent body, because they can only go before a sanction committee, which is reporting to management and which is part of management. And this is not part of the inspection panel procedure, where you have independent outsiders investigating into what the bank is doing. So there's obviously other than the World Bank, many more international organizations that don't have yet something like the inspection panel. And there is lots of creativity that can still be unleashed with respect to holding international organizations accountable. Now, let me come to my second point here, and I'm again identifying a gap in international law. And this is what I believe is the fact that the framework for the global economy is defective in the sense that it also has a lot of gaps, or is actually some sort of a framework where you have imbalances. And the reason being because under the WTO arrangements and under the international financial institutions conditionalities that design the macroeconomic framework and the legal framework of most of the third world countries, we are facing a one-way street. We're not facing a two-way street. You can take the WTO as the easiest example. Look at the bargaining for liberalization commitments that takes place within the WTO. Obviously, the bargaining powers are with the northern countries. And the moment one bargains as a third world country to reduce tariffs and quotas, third world countries are at a loss, to the extent that most often at the end of the bargaining process, the southern countries reduce their tariffs and quotas a lot, open their markets for the northern countries, while there is no reciprocity in the sense that the north doesn't open itself up to the same extent. Similarly, you have a one-way street in the sense that under Washington consensus conditionalities, the international financial institutions ask the developing countries to liberalize their trade, to liberalize their financial and capital markets. But again, since these are conditionalities to which only the third world countries are subject to, there is no equivalent of liberalizing of trade and financial and capital markets from the south, from the northern side, so that the southern countries can enjoy the same liberal regime in the north. And the best way to explain this and illustrate to what extent the South is at a loss is if you take the example of Turkey. Turkey is right now subject to the Washington Consensus, but it has that future possibility to join the European Union. The moment it would join actually the European Union, there would be a two-way street, and there would be not only Turkey opening itself up for European companies, but Turkey enjoying the same zero quotas, zero tariffs, the same freedom of movements of goods and everything that every other member of the European Union enjoys. Now, I personally, I would really redesign the framework for the global economy, because I really believe this should be going into the direction of a true market economy, in the sense of there being a two-way street and both sides, north and south, playing on a level playing field. That is the more fair regime, in my view, for the global economy. So right now, the stage at which we are is still a one-way street, and the first step that was taken to kind of shift the balance back was the establishment of the HIPC Trust Fund, in the sense of empowering developing countries, getting rid of much of their excessive debt in order to start again being partner in the global economy. This is just a very, very tiny step in the right direction. The remainder is a huge project, would definitely go beyond the Doha Development Agenda, and would certainly mean a big redesigning of the conditionalities of the international financial institutions, way beyond the Washington Consensus, in the sense that right now the medicine for third world countries looks like as if we are exporting the 19th century framework of the U.S. economy to the third world, with all the robber barons that have the free ride over there. And this is not what I'm in favor of. I would like to have the Global Securities Exchange Commission and a global antitrust authority and the like, so that in fact everybody could enjoy the same starting points and play equally with equal powers on a level playing field. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sabine. Claudio.
Let me see, trying to follow the different question asked by Professor Ferlo. In terms of developments, one thing that we cannot ignore is that we're coming out of what was the organizing principle of international relations, the fact that we used to live in a bipolar world. And to a certain extent, the multiple conflicts that existed in the world had irrational and were subsumed in a conflict between two superpowers, and that gave some organization to the international relations. The end of the Cold War has resulted in a new world reality, where new conflicts have emerged, and the instruments and mechanisms that we have not yet proven its full efficiency in handling those conflicts, I would say. Now, in terms of failures, I think that there is a legitimate questions as to whether the way in which we have structured international relations and international law is solving fundamental issues facing humankind. Another way to see this is a question of relevance. and let me ask, I mean, if we establish priorities, even establishing priorities could reveal a political preference or value. For example, we live in a world where poverty is a very serious issue. If the international system and international law doesn't have a priority in terms of solving the problem of poverty, we face a lot of serious issues, waves of refugees, political instability, opportunities for the use of violence and that type of thing. Now, do you think that international law as it stands is a dynamic and important force in fighting poverty, for example? So there is an issue of priority there. And second thing, proliferation of nuclear weapons, both horizontal and vertical. The non-proliferation treaty established a regime under which non-nuclear weapon states committed themselves not to go nuclear weapon. Eh? I mean, not to. Now, there has been an expansion of technologies that basically allow for the following. The material used for peaceful technology could be turned into material used for the development of atomic weapons. Also, all the non-proliferation treaty regime was based on this idea that you can have peaceful nuclear technology and that you could contain it and it could not be used for other purposes. But nuclear technology is only one. So when you have the capabilities, the knowledge, I mean, is it possible? And what are the constraints that would limit some states from going nuclear? What about horizontal proliferation of nuclear weapons? I mean, and the use of immense resources of humankind in continuing to build the nuclear weapon arsenals. I mean, again, question, because these are issues, important issues facing humankind as we see around 30 states that are at the verge of becoming nuclear weapon states. And we're seeing now a very serious issue with Iran. The whole regime of supervision established under the International Atomic Energy Agency and under the Non-Proliferation Treaty resulted in non-nuclear weapon states having the obligation of accepting inspections, for example. And the inspection regime is very serious. I mean, inspection is supervising conduct through standards, and then because of the nature of the nuclear proliferation, inspector can go to a country, could put seals and that type of thing. And we see what's going on now in challenging the regime of inspection of the International Atomic Energy Agency. But the problem is broader, and I mentioned some of the components of this problem. Now, again, do we think that in terms of the control of weapons of mass destruction, we have established in international relations and international law a regime that allows for that? Then, let me see, compliance with basic human rights norms, the access to communications, what was called in the 60s in Latin America the effect of demonstration. I mean, people turn on the TV and see that there are good things of life, that people could have a level of material enjoyment of life and comfort. They can see that some people could say what they think. And that type of, environment raises expectations by individuals. Human rights norms and compliance with human rights norms allow the development of individuals to the limit of their potential and limit, among other things, the exercise of arbitrary power. Now, have we developed in international relations and international norms structures, institutions that will ensure the environment and the opportunities and possibilities for everyone to develop himself or herself to the limit of their potential? Now, settlement of disputes. Again, there are many ways to settle disputes. One is the most powerful wins, correlation of forces, including material forces, cohesion and so forth and so on, and there are means to solve disputes that are basically judicial, that you go to independent individuals that measure conduct on the basis of a set of abstract norms that apply to everyone. Now, do we live in a reality where disputes facing nations or individuals with nations are solved on the basis of judicial models? Again, it should that be a very important priority when we see the proliferation of situations all over the world that involve conflicts? Now, at the bottom of these conflicts, there is a very there are a couple of issues. One is this: the need to mediate nationalism and the power of national states with the multilateral organizations and international organizations, because the world order based on the absolute of power, a power of states to do what they wanted, was a feature of the law as developed by Hugo Grotius, the father of modern international law. If you go to a library here, you will see even the books written by the authors of the time. One was the Law of War and the Law of Peace. International treaties could be terminated validly by a declaration of war. Imagine if I sell you a house and I can say, well, the house returns to me when I declare war to you. Huh? That was the law of war. Basically, war was a valid national option for the states in the classic system of international law and a valid way to terminate the validity of international obligations. So that expressed the absolute value of national sovereignty to do as nations wanted. No obligation without acceptance, the basic norm of Kelsen, except that under classic international law, that obligation ceased when there was a declaration of war. Now, have we changed fundamentally that, or not, in the sense that the permanence of international obligations is irrespective of national power? Do we have something beyond that? And what is the right balance between national sovereignty and the role of multinational, multilateral organization? We know that there is hardly an issue that can be solved by a country alone. If we take a look at proliferation of nuclear weapons, terrorism, poverty, human rights, well, individual states by themselves, because of the, I don't want to say the international component of every issue, we don't even have the terminology, because the terminology international domestic shows like two neat separate concepts, and the concepts are something that has elements of everything. I mean, the different issues, every issue has elements from everything. So we see assertions of national power, and at the same time we see problems that cannot be solved exclusively by national states themselves. Of course, there is the states who have more or less powers in international relations, but we see increasingly that even the most powerful states require international cooperation because of the change of the nature of the issues facing humankind in order to protect their own citizens. So for me, there has been successes of international law. Of course, we have established an International Bill of Rights, we have established the United Nations with the Security Council with the power to enforce under Chapter 7 enforcement measures. So there are some things that we have a network of international organizations, but still the political realities show a tension between the power of national states and the assertion of power by international organizations that is required to solve the problems facing humankind. Now, in terms of challenges, I think that the most important challenge is to creatively solve that tension between national sovereignty and the need to solve the problem of humankind because of the nature of problems we're facing, and what is the proper balance between both. And I think that we're in a in some type of transition. Now, again, it's not enough to ask for more power to international organizations on the basis of goodwill. I mean, the question is what space is really available to move ahead on a pragmatic agenda for change. And in these matters, unfortunately, sometimes failure of policies is required. I mean, the adoption of the International Bill of Rights needed, unfortunately, to be preceded by the Second World War. It seems that a lot of people have to die before we can do the right thing if we don't destroy the planet in the process. Now, but again, the question is what conditions are there to move ahead in terms of an international agenda that strikes the proper balance between the different aspects involved? And again, we don't have that will happen in a, let me see, chaotic way depending on the nature of the issue involved. I mean, this is not in the international community is not an organized community like a national state, sometimes where the Congress could adopt norms or the authoritarian executive. So what I foresee is that we're going to have leap and bounds, and we have to seize opportunities depending on the subject matter and the conditions existing. And the role of lawyers, or one role of lawyers, is to see what possibilities exist in order to move ahead in the different aspects, in the different challenges facing individuals, sometimes and nations. Sometimes regional arrangements could be afford possibilities, sometimes the technical or agencies of the United Nations. And we need to be realistic and take a look at that. I think that strengthening the role of supervision is strategically very important. Supervision is measuring conduct against standards. And there are different types of supervision, political supervision, semi-judicial, judicial. Every time that we can push for judicial supervision, we are achieving a very important goal. At the end, that judicial supervision reflects the highest values of a legal system, namely that irrespective of political power and irrespective of other influences, there is a belief that certain norms apply to everyone fairly could achieve justice. And there is a value there if we share democratic values. I mean, because let me finish with this. When we ask what are the developments, the failures, the challenges, and what lawyers can do, I think that that question cannot be answered without the perspective. If you are a fundamentalist who doesn't believe in democracy and tolerance and pluralism, or you are a fanatic, or you think, it's the ways in which you are going to see this is different. If your point, and I would suggest, and with this I finish, that answering these questions requires a point of departure. And everyone should choose the point of departure. And the point of departure is essential to see how we solve this problem. For me, a point of departure is a point of departure based in a common language of humankind, which is the International Bill of Rights, in a preference for judicial means of solving problems, and in a recognition that we're facing in a very important situation in the world where the distinction between domestic and international is, to say the least, not as acute as it happened in the past. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Claudia. Raj.
Thank you for inviting me to this program. First of all, let me start by saying how delighted I am to be here. 15 years ago, it was a very different program, and it was a different building, it was a different set of people, and the resources that were available were different, but there were a lot of things that were actually quite similar to what you might have experienced today. I mean, not that I don't envy you for being in a much better building but than what I was 15 years ago, but the richness of the faculty, the commitment of the school to social justice, and the rich diversity of the students who come from around the world that provided such an incredible educational experience all remain. So I'm really delighted to be here as part of this celebration. So let me start by, we have four very large questions that Danny Bradlaugh has put before us, and some of which have already been ably answered by the people who spoke before me. So let me just put forward a few views at least two of the four questions. And perhaps we can discuss more if we have any time for discussion. Firstly, the two of the most important developments in international law over the last 25 years, and I would put forward two different issues. One is the rise of the human rights movement as a global movement, and the rise, together with it, of what I would call as universal political consciousness and the popularization of human rights. And secondly, also as part of that development, the evolution of human rights, and this is the kind of the dark side to the story, the evolution of human rights also as a hegemonic discourse, which ends up legitimating a number of different ways of exercise of state power. And secondly, a very important development in international in the last 25 years is, I would say, the incredible expansion in the reach and agendas of international economic and financial institutions, a topic that has been touched on, particularly the World Bank and the IMF, but also the World Trade Organization, and their impact on basic international law doctrines of sovereign equality and self-determination, as well as on doctrines of state responsibility. So firstly, I think that what's interesting about the human rights movement is the last 25 years is the way in which it became much more universal even within the state system. For example, I'm thinking of the expansion of the UN Commission on Human Rights with the inclusion of new developing countries that joined the commission in 1979, the expansion of the agenda of the UN human rights system in the 1980s that began to include many more issues of that were typically not on the human rights agenda, including issues of economic and social justice, of development, of democracy, and a number of related issues. But I think that what's interesting about the human rights movement is that the universalization of the human rights movement in the state system was also accompanied by the rise of what Sam Huntington has referred to as the rise of the third wave of democracy. Democratization happening in Latin America, in Eastern Europe, and in Asia, and the overthrow of military dictatorships, and the introduction of new normative languages of popular rule and legitimation through popular rule. And this has actually emerged at the transnational level through the evolution of what scholars refer to as transnational social movement networks that in turn have a tremendous impact on international law making and implementation, as well as on horizontally speaking between countries on constitution making or transnational campaigns or policy networks. Professor Goldman referred to the Landmines Convention, which I think is very appropriate. But I think that broadly, I think we need to see this as part of a broader popularization of human rights, the way in which human rights have hit the ground in many ways, which I don't think many people could have anticipated 25 years ago. And second thing is that, as I said, human rights also has a dark side. Even as it becomes more popular, it has actually acquired hegemonic characteristics, particularly in two senses of the term. First, in the security dimension, the rights discourse is, I would say, right now it provides a glinting edge of muscular humanitarianism. Through the evolution of numerous norms for intervention, including the right to the doctrine of humanitarian intervention, pro-democratic intervention, or the freedom agenda pursued by the current American government, human rights emerging as a formula for rebuilding failed states, or the doctrine of responsibility to protect, which has emerged as a way to sort of inject a rights-based reading of sovereignty into the world agenda, which I think has some problems associated with it. And secondly, in the development field, rights discourse is increasingly hegemonic in the sense in which it delimits the progressive politics that states could pursue under earlier rules of international law for example, by restricting the talk about justice to, say, economic and social rights, or to rights-based development, which is a popular way of talking about development in international organizations and donor community. It actually restricts, for example, the kinds of policies that states could pursue in earlier decades. One thinks of, for example, a strong role of the state in import substitution, which actually formed an important part of the success story of the countries that grew most rapidly in the 1960s, like Brazil in 1960s, or the so-called East Asian tigers. And all those lessons suddenly seem to have been thrown out of the window. And all progressive politics is now, you know, restricted to a talk about rights, which, as somebody who is deeply committed to the idea of rights, I find very, you know, ambivalent about. So, and the second issue, as I said, an important development has been the incredible expansion in the reach and power of international economic institutions, especially their impact on doctrines of sovereign equality and self-determination. I would say that since the 70s, if you compare where the World Bank and the IMF's agenda was, and the nature of the trading system, the GATT, and particularly its dispute resolution mechanism, we didn't have anything close to what we have now. But I think what's more worrying is actually that international institutions seem to have institutionalized sovereign inequality in their structure, as for example in the voting structures and the decision-making structures in the WTO, in their functioning, especially through the evolution of particular programs and norms that are targeted at only particular third world countries, such as structural adjustment, while the mechanisms in international law for recognizing de facto and equal power relations, such as one thinks of, for example, a special and differential treatment rule in trade law, are getting ignored or are getting irrelevant for a variety of reasons. A sub-point of this broad issue of the evolution of the growth of international institutions is their impact on the doctrine of state responsibility. I think the point that I want to make is that powerful states have successfully managed to deflect attention from the legal consequences of their wrongful acts by camouflaging them in the acts of international organizations. Despite the work of the International Law Commission on state responsibility recently and the work of the International Law Association on the responsibilities of international organizations, I think that we are faced with a world where states simply do not have, you know, ways of making, ensuring that state conduct that violates their rights actually is held responsible and that people are allowed to account for them. I think that that's a big problem. I'm totally out of time, so let me just put the two big problems that international law has failed to resolve in the past 25 years, and I'm not going to discuss them, I'm just going to put them on the agenda so we can probably discuss them during question time. The first is, I would say, the big issue that has always been in international law: how do you ensure order in a world of sovereign states, particularly on rules governing use of force? And I would submit that international law has miserably failed in ensuring that the rules and mechanisms that ensure, you know, some level of accountability for illegal or illegitimate use of force have not really evolved. And secondly, I would say that there continues to be an incredible anti-third world colonial bias in international law, which was very well known in the 1970s. Much of, you know, the work both at the level of state politics and at the level of scholarship was devoted to uncovering some of these hidden biases and blind spots in, for example, the law of use of force or the law of international economic law in areas like expropriation, but they actually have not really been meaningfully addressed. And I would say that you know, they are going to continue to be with us as large issues, which go to the root of some of the earlier political points that were made, particularly the increasing north-south inequality, as well as inequality and increasing tension within countries. So I will leave you at that, and thank you.
Thanks very much, Raj. Ritzel.
Good morning. May I just make reference to one person that has not been mentioned today, which is Professor Covey Oliver, who, when I was studying, he was one of the professors here, and I understand that he passed away a few weeks ago. What I found interesting with Professor Covey Oliver, and that is without any discredit to Claudio and Professor Goldman, was that even though he gave a course in international trade, attending his course was like attending a general formation of thinking about law and dealing with the law in a comprehensive way, and not being blinded by any adjective that would make you a specialist. And I believe that looking forward and looking backward today, 25 years ahead, we should try to do so. And I think that the panel has touched on several issues, and we see the interlinkages in them. So if you ask me what are the two most important things that have been left behind or were important, I would say let's try to look at certain structures that have changed and how these structures will continue to change. And second, indeed, the position of international organizations. As regards the structure, I think that if you compare a textbook of 1982 with a textbook of today, you will find in the old books the term committee in international law very frequently used. Whereas if you compare a textbook today, you will see less and less of that. So one question is, how come that comity, which used to be a very important notion in the teaching and understanding of international law, has become less important over the last 25 years? I will illustrate that with one area of law in which I'm currently involved in my daily employment. If we look back 25 years ago, in the area of law enforcement cooperation, you will see that that was premised and governed by the idea that states and countries do not enforce each other's public law, certainly not each other's criminal law. And then when they agreed to cooperate with each other, that was very limited and very restrictive, and they set very specific conditions to their mutual assistance. I believe that things have changed and things are being changed. I must say that I was always surprised by this attitude in mutual law, mutual cooperation, because if you go back to 1949 when the International Court of Justice passed the judgment in the Court of the Channel case, you will see that it was very clear from that judgment that in the case a country knows that something harmful can happen in its territory to another state, that it has a duty to inform the other state so that in order to prevent the harmful act to take place. But still, attitudes in law enforcement cooperation has always been discretionary, voluntary, and never any link was made between this principle that you find in the Crawford Channel case and the daily operation of law enforcement. However, if we see the various treaties that have been adopted since 1982, including some just before that, you will see increasingly a general statement in each of those conventions saying that countries have agreed to provide each other the widest possible mutual cooperation in matters of law enforcement. That is a feature of the conventions that you do not find easily in many of the conventions existing before 1982. A second feature of those conventions is that they go one step further in making a little bit more concrete what is understood to be mutual cooperation. They impose the duty to cooperate and the duty to inform more concretely than ever before. Those two elements that you find now in the treaties governing either whether it is the Anti-Corruption Convention of the United Nations, whether it is the various terrorism instruments that have been adopted, those two elements clearly require a change in attitude. In our day-to-day work, we see that despite the existence now in the law of those concrete obligations to cooperate and to exchange information, we do see that the mistrust that existed before still exists. The behavior of countries do not measure up with the undertakings that they have made in the various conventions. And that is an area which I believe, if we look back to 25 years, how come that states undertake those conventions, and nevertheless, there is no connection with the actual practice? We still believe that countries, and we still find that countries, refuse to exchange information when it is critical. I give you an example. Last year, a terrorist attack was fought in the United Kingdom. A modus operandi was identified, and they closed down the whole aviation in the UK for one day. But until today, it is not known what the modus operandi was. This information has not been shared, to my knowledge, with any country, at least not to the knowledge of Interpol. But what if today a similar attack is being prepared in another country, and that attack is successful? Wouldn't we say, based on the standards employed in the Kofu Channel case, as well as the various conventions that I have referred to, wouldn't we say that the United Kingdom has failed in its duty to cooperate? I believe that if we look at the recent judgment of the International Court of Justice in the genocide case, we have reason to believe that things may change in the coming 25 years. Because in that judgment, the Court of Justice decided that Serbia was responsible for its failure to prevent. And in finding that way, the court based this on the treaty provision that require countries to prevent the actions of genocide. I believe that this judgment, with the elements contained in it, will be an impetus to moving the area of discretionary attitude towards cooperation in criminal matters into a much more regulated and concerted action to cooperate. That is certainly a big change that will happen. I don't have time to go into the second area I would have liked to discuss with you, which is the area of accountability of international organizations. Let me briefly say, first of all, that the inspection panel of the World Bank is not the first body governing and supervising international organizations with respect to their actions to global organizations. I think the Interpol Commission for the Control of Interpol Files of 1982 is the first one, and Professor Grossman is a member of that commission, whose task is to hold Interpol to the standards of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights with respect to the area of privacy as far as concerns all our databases. But I believe that what misses and what will have to be addressed in the coming 25 years is what has been identified by the European Court of Human Rights in the White and Kennedy case, where the court, recognizing that international organizations are not states and do not have the same powers as states, the court has decided that if an international organization does not provide effective remedy, judicial remedy, to a private party who feels aggrieved, then the states who are members of that organization are responsible to provide that. Unfortunately, that has led to a lot of doctrinal speculation about limiting the immunity of international organizations. I believe that is the wrong way to go. The right way to go, I believe, is to think in terms of the establishment of a standing body which has the power to deal with claims, non-contractual claims to international organizations and private parties, just as in the case as the ICSID which we have here in Washington. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ruth. So I want to thank all the panelists for giving us a very rich diversity of issues to discuss and to consider in thinking about the evolution of international law. We have about 15 or 20 minutes for questions. I'd invite all of you who have questions to please come and talk to the microphone. These sessions are being webcast and podcast, so if you could identify yourself when you answer the when you ask a question, that would be useful as well. Ali. Okay. You need to turn the microphone on.
Thank the panel for the wonderful presentation. It's not clear? No? I think it's for...
Yes.
Again, I thank the panel for the presentations, and you really open our appetite to talk about human rights. I would like to talk about the terrorism. So far, the international community have failed to define terrorism. So I would like to ask Professor Goldman, how do you define it, and how do you make difference between the right of self-determination and the terrorism. And the Iraqi question, what is applicable law now in Iraq? You used to say that we are occupying Iraq. So during this occupation, what is going on there? How do you describe it? The taking of hostage, the attacking of civilians, hijacking civilians, are they war crimes or act of terrorism? And which law is applicable in this case? Is it international humanitarian law, international human rights law, the domestic law, the international criminal law? It's confusing for me. Thank you.
Thank you. If there are other questions, we can take a couple of questions and then...
Thank you. My name is Hadi. I would like, for me, it's a very interesting the topic because about the evolution of international law, especially how to make the balance, the equality between the, as the speaker said that about the balance between the North and the South or developing countries and developed countries, which is we haven't seen that, but it will evolve in the international law that the equality in for the countries in the world. But how long it's gonna be takes? Is it another 25 years to be the equality? So, however, the international law also failed to prevent the excessive the use of force in international relations. So that it's gonna be evolved in another 25 years that the international law will be more strong. In in order to make the relations is more equal. Thank you.
Well, I think let's have some answers to those questions. Bob, I think the first one was addressed to you, really.
Well, it's true. There is not a single accepted definition. It's been debated, and it continues to be debated within the United Nations and so forth. And I doubt very seriously if they are going to arrive so long as Western opposition and opposition, as you know, from certain quarters and states which do not want to see things, for instance, as suicide bombers used by groups involved in liberation struggles are going to be deemed to be not acts of terrorism. I held for 1 year a job with the UN as an independent expert on terrorism and human rights, and one of the things I had to do was to look at some of these issues. So very briefly, let me tell you, I think the absence of a definition of terrorism internationally is not that material. The fact is the train's left the station. You have both at the national level, regional level, and sub-regional levels around the world very elaborate definitions of terrorism. And they have proliferated to such an extent that I would severely doubt that particularly where many regimes use these definitions, because they are so broad, in no way comport with the basic principle of legality. No one could possibly. In many cases, you can't distinguish those definitions of terrorism from people who use violence in an ordinary criminal act and can be detained and tried as terrorists, that it's going to make any difference in the long run. Plus, you do have in the terrorist, the suppression of financing of terrorism, which has been ratified by 100 and some states, you do have a basic definition there. I've yet to see a definition of terrorism that is written with sufficient particularity that it can pass muster under fundamental principles of international criminal law and international human rights law, because it subsumes too many kinds of conduct. A far better approach, in my view, is that you take well-recognized crimes, and if the motive for the commission of the act is to compel or a government or authority to do or to abstain from doing something, and or, again, using the word terrorize, for instance, the civilian population, then you increase the penalties. Defining terrorism in and of itself, however, as I said, is extremely difficult, and there's been much written on that. Secondly, on the issue in Iraq, well, Iraq has evolved from an international armed conflict at the time of the Coalition of the Willing, as it's called in Washington, undertook the military action. Then we proclaimed a belligerent occupation. And it was the first time, interestingly, that the Fourth Geneva Convention has applied to an armed conflict. Technically, the occupation has ended. Whether or not the Maliki government is entirely free to pursue policies independent of what the United States wants remains an open question. But the international community has accepted it as a sovereign government. I would argue that what is ongoing in Iraq today is a non-international armed conflict in which the United States function at the behest of the government, which is widely recognized at this point. There's not four or five armed conflicts going on at one time, but a single armed conflict with multiple actors. And consequently, you have the law of non-international armed conflict that takes place. And the law of non-international armed conflict, just as the law of international armed conflict, why they do not expressly define terrorism, they do deal with notions of terrorism. Deliberately attacking civilians and civilian objects, the taking of hostages, the engaging in summary executions would be serious violations of the law of non-international armed conflict and incidentally within the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. Insofar as human rights law also applies, and interestingly, it not only applies with respect to the conduct of the Iraqi authorities. And there are questions that can be raised to the extent that it has acquiesced, certainly in the past, and tolerated the existence of death squads, if not more than condoned, if not at certain of the various highest levels, particularly on the Shia side, that the state may not have some responsibility for those acts. But interestingly, certainly the Human Rights Committee and the European Court have found extraterritorial application of human rights obligations, and indeed the British openly accept that their obligations under the European Convention on Human Rights applies as such in Iraq. So you have a very, very interesting set of circumstances, in my view. As I said, it's a non-international armed conflict with multiple actors, human rights law obviously applying with respect to the state and its agents, as well as the law of non-international armed conflict, which would apply to all of the warring parties. The last thing that I'll say is it is frequently overlooked. The law of armed conflict applies to all persons within the territory of the state, be they state agents or be they dissident forces. Individual civilians or individuals who cross international frontiers, who decide, for instance, to engage in private warfare for whatever reason, they are subject also to the rules of international humanitarian law, and they are as capable of committing a violation of IHL as a member of, for instance, regular armed forces of the state or of the coalition forces.
Yeah. Dean Gerson.
I think that in terms of human dignity and the protection for individuals in international law, it has been very important to establish the following principle, that it doesn't matter how just is your cause, but still, no matter how just is your cause, there are some things you cannot do. Let me establish a caricature, and perhaps we will all agree with it. Imagine you have a very just cause and you want to eat the children of your enemy. Would you accept that? Eat them alive, put them on a barbecue? We wouldn't, right? So, in the past, that was possible. I mean, I would say that the idea has been of humanity that, and that is the underlying principle of international humanitarian law and human rights, that no matter how just is your cause, because let us face it, nobody doubts, or some do, but it's an exception, the justice of their own causes. In this hemisphere, in the Western Hemisphere, we have thousands of just causes. We have hundreds of millions of individuals who live under the poverty line. We have one out of every four women are the object of domestic violence. We have, and I can go on and on. So the whole idea of humanitarian law and human rights is, yes, your justice cause. Your cause is just. But there are some things you cannot do. Very important also, you cannot invoke the principle of reciprocity. In the sense of that, well, my enemy, which is by definition pretty evil and bad, and I'm right, he's wrong, that's, you know, my enemy, he did this awful thing to me, so I can do the same to him. I mean, the whole idea of international humanitarian law and war crimes is that the principle of reciprocity doesn't apply. Now, we have problems of definition in every legal concept. Property, I mean, has problems of definition, strict liability has problems of definition, but there are some things that are clear and some things that are more doubtful. So my view on this matter is that we need to reassert the issue that the end doesn't justify the means, that the means are an anticipation of the ends that you pursue. Second, I think the legitimate struggles for self-determination, because they're not forbidden in international law. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights does not forbid. To the contrary, it starts with the right of self-determination, the old decolon. But if somebody says to me, my cause is just, and then I'm going to blow up a school with little children because my cause is just, or you did this wrongdoing to me, I don't accept it. You know, I also politically want to call the attention of everyone that the powerful also think that the cause is just. And the idea that we are going to establish limits also apply to the powerful. So when people say I'm more weak, I have those very deeply felt grievances and I can do whatever I want. Well, if we convince powerful actors in the international community that there are no limits at all, they also are going to use their power without any limit. And when they do, we need to criticize them. So for me then, the defense of civilization depends on this idea that, don't tell me that you're just, your cause is just, because I know, I mean, everyone thinks they feel very intensively the strength of their ideas, and but it happens to be that everyone feels the same. So what we can agree is one thing only, because we're not, I mean, hopefully we will agree on the merits. But if we cannot agree on the merits, we need to agree that certain things are not acceptable. And that is the value of international humanitarian law and the law of human rights. And we need to reassert that important value of civilization, because the survival of humankind depends on that, with the proliferation of the weapons of mass destruction as well. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. In the last few minutes we have left, I'm going to ask each of the other panelists to respond to either of the questions, which cover a lot of what we talked about. So.
Thank you. The North-South issue, right, and the issue including the whole issue of poverty, the fact is poverty keeps increasing both within countries, and the inequalities, regional inequalities within countries keeps increasing. So you have regions of China that are closer in terms of their, you know, economic growth and infrastructure and per capita, much closer to Japan, and then you have regions of China that are completely like, you know, where China was, you know, 50 years ago. I think that the whole question of North-South, you know, could be looked at, and I think you're going to get dramatically different answers from different people. I really think that it's a question of people looking at it as either a glass that's half empty or half full. I just, you know, take the view that, in fact, the glass is not only half empty, that is getting emptier. That even the rules that were available under international law to enable states, for example, to address poverty in a meaningful way are all being whittled down. What do I mean by that? I mean, to take one example, the World Bank says, according to its own estimates, that one of the most dramatic reductions of poverty has actually taken place in Asia, particularly in China. Millions have been, you know, have found their living standards improved. But the foundation for that was laid by China using policies that would have been completely inconsistent under current system of international law, particularly under the current WTO standards relating to either patents or copyrights or relating to the state's involvement in industrialization protection, or the state's engagement with the capital markets. The rules as they exist right now do not enable developing countries to pursue policies that were perfectly legitimate for Western countries to pursue. For example, in the late 19th century, the tariff regime in the United States was among the highest. The kind of protectionism that the United States engaged in against exports from Europe was among the highest. The kind of protection that was given to intellectual property was entirely dictated by national considerations. Now, you cannot see any developing country that could pursue such a policy at this stage, because the rules have changed, the institutions have changed, and I think that that's part of the problem of looking at international law purely as an international lawyer. If you look at it, it's wonderful that we have another great international institution, the WTO, which has its own dispute resolution mechanism, so we all take trade law courses, read its dispute resolution body reports, and applaud the fact that international law is marching towards this future. But on the other hand, it could be part of the problem, really, that maybe it's not a good idea to have too much international law in some areas. I say it may be a controversial claim to make, particularly in the International Legal Studies program, which obviously takes international law to be this unmedicated good. But it could have problems for countries. If international law is in fact a neutral instrument using which states can pursue and people within states can pursue their own idea of the good, in fact, if it works that way, it's wonderful. We should have more and more international law. But not if it turns out to be, you know, for example, an instrument in the hand of the more powerful, which I think it has been. Of course, this requires a lot of explication. So we can discuss more during coffee break or something. But I just think that it's there are a lot of issues that need to be more critically engaged here.
Thank you. Ritzo.
Thank you. I would like to say something about the issue of definition of terrorism. I think we have to be careful that the efforts currently underway in the UN, rather than helping us to combat terrorism, it may turn into a fig leaf to protect those who would like to take some actions that are obviously violations of human rights, take them out of the ambit of criminal law enforcement. If you look at the various conventions that have been adopted since 1961, on terrorism, you will find that each of them defines a specific form of terrorist act and imposes on the countries the obligation to criminalize and punish those acts. I do not see any of those conventions authorizing a state to say, look, in this case, the motive behind the terrorist act was so noble, and consequently, you are not. There is no reason to enforce the terrorist definition in that specific convention. So I do not see how a comprehensive convention can add to the existing definitions without limiting basically the scope of application of what currently is understood as being criminal. So I am doubtful whether that is the right way, the right course to go. Let me just very short say something also about the role of international organizations. I believe that we should not confuse the actions of international organizations that are affecting private parties directly with those that affect the life of private parties indirectly. With regard to the first group, I believe that there's a need and that it's incumbent of all lawyers to make sure that organizations are held accountable when their actions are directly directed to private parties. I do not see it the same way when it is simply an incident, like in the case of the international financial institutions. Thank you.
Sabine, you have the last word.
Well, I personally find it absurd that if we're talking about the North-South divide that is increasing, if we're saying that the rules have changed in the sense that why don't we allow developing countries to establish barriers to trade, and I'm actually disagreeing with my colleague here, because it is the northern countries that have established barriers to trade from the south into the north, and it is the north that behaves in a protectionist way, and they can allow for doing so because they have the greater bargaining power within the WTO, and they are not the ones who are subject to conditionalities by lending from the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank. They have long stopped lending from the International Monetary Fund, and that's when actually the list of the conditionalities became much longer and became very comprehensive and translated itself into what I call is the export of the 19th century regime for the economy of the northern countries in the 21st century to the south, while the north at home has to behave according to very different standards. And I believe we miss out on a historic chance here, because at the end of the 80s, it was clear that the planned economies broke down. The Berlin Wall fell. And that was the chance when, in fact, the better economic regime, meaning the market economy, what could be exported to the South, and it's not done primarily. So, in fact, what we are doing in the South is we're privatizing and turning state monopolies into private monopolies. So, in essence, we're not having competition over there, while we still guard that in our own countries. And I'm really in favor of saying that and not doing as if we are exporting market economy.
Thank you. I'm being told that our time is up, that we need to move to the cafeteria for lunch. I just want to end with one thought and then with one thank you. The one thought I have is, it strikes me that the one issue which hasn't come up for discussion by anybody is the importance of international environmental law, which has grown dramatically over the last 25 years. And as we face the problem of climate change, I think it's probably one of the big challenges for the next 25 years. But I want to thank everyone on
the
panel.
Thank you, Al Gore.
Pardon?
I said, thank you, Al Gore.
Not fat enough. I want to thank everyone on the panel for a wonderfully rich discussion. Thank everyone in the audience. Just, I need to give you an instruction. In order to get to the cafeteria, you should go up the stairs at the top, and there'll be people who directing you to the cafeteria for the lunch and the keynote address by Ana Palacio from the World Bank. The reason you need to go that way is that there's another event that's going to be taking place in this room while we're having lunch, and so we need to make sure that the movement of people is efficient. So thank you.